From JetBooks, this is Irish Business Builders, a show about great Irish businesses and the people who built them. Head to jetbooks.ie/resources to pick up our free step-by-step guide on how to automate your bookkeeping.
You know, I didn't really have any structure in my life. I'd probably stopped the gym. I went from training incredibly hard to then suddenly nothing. And I remember from that, I was focusing on the wrong things in Zumbrero. I was running around the place like a madman when I actually needed a bit of structure and schedule in my day.
I'm Conor Carney, and that's the voice of Dara Fanning, General Manager at Zumbrero Ireland, an Australian burrito franchise taking the world by storm. Dara is a former professional rugby player with both Connacht and Leinster who fell into the franchise restaurant business through a close contact he made while playing rugby in Australia. In this conversation, Dara tells us about how giving up on his rugby dreams actually led to becoming a professional player, why he left the highest level of sport to open up a business, and how Zumbrero is saving the world one burrito at a time. I started off by asking Dara about Zumbrero and its mission to solve world hunger.
Zumbrero is an Australian franchise founded by a 21-year-old medical student doctor of Sri Lankan Scottish heritage, serving healthy Mexican food, which has a mission to stop world hunger.
Who's the doctor?
So our founder is a guy called Dr. Sam Prince, really interesting guy. I've met him a few times in Australia, who actually started all when he was 21, fitted out his first restaurant himself on a budget. I think he had $15,000. His first day in business, he had one customer, and he's gone on to grow it now to 200 plus restaurants across Australia, New Zealand, Ireland, and America.
And there's no, are there none in the UK?
We're not in the UK yet. We are exploring it. So it was part of when we took it to Ireland was always with a longer term view of the UK. It was to get the model up and going. That's how Sean pitched the idea to Sam at the time. Mm-hmm. Was, you know, go to Ireland, similar market but a smaller market, get it to scale here, get an understanding of how people would like the product in Ireland and adapt it to, because it was always going to be different between Australia and Ireland. And then with a view to go to Australia with sort of an aggressive rollout plan. So actually in only the last month, there's now someone from head office in Australia now has moved to London with a view to rolling out restaurants. To be honest, where we are at the moment, I'd say we could be 12 months off opening over there because it's a tough market to break into. It's huge. You know what I mean? You could have 8 restaurants in London and be absolutely nothing. Yeah. So you need to go in, at scale. So she's there now and on the ground trying to figure out, and I suppose a tough time to be there.
And what about solving world hunger?
Yeah, we've lots of different taglines, like Feel Good Mex is the big one for us, but we have other ones like Let's Eat to Beat World Hunger, which is an interesting one that we actually had a number of complaints about, like people coming in to restaurants, because we sometimes have it up in signs. We actually had a complaint only a week ago on social media that we shouldn't be posting things like that. And then it was great because it was an opportunity for me to reply and explain what we're actually doing. So Play for Plate is an initiative that Sam started in year 2 with Zumbrero and backdated it to meal one day, one that one customer we served first day. And how it works is for every burrito or bowl sold in any Zumbrero restaurant, we donate a meal to someone in need through a charity partner called Rise Against Hunger. And to date, we've actually donated over 42 million meals. So it's growing all the time. It's growing at a rapid rate. Like every month, there's new restaurants obviously opening, which is adding more and more meals. And I think at the moment, we're about 300,000 meals, 300,000 to 400,000 meals a month. So the company goal is 1 billion meals by 2025.
Has that helped the success, do you think, of Zumbrero?
Yeah, I'd say there's an element that people do like it. People, particularly for me, when I'm talking to franchise partners, it's something they always mention that they love that element of the business. And Sam always preaches that, you know, it's in our DNA, and it literally is. You know, his background, his parents were born in Sri Lanka and went through quite tough times. And his mother, who was obviously a highly intelligent woman, went to a school. And the reason she went to that school every day is because she got fed breakfast and lunch. So she knew she went to school every day, she got fed. So he said, like, you know, his mother wouldn't have got out of Sri Lanka. She got to the UK and then from there to Scotland and from there to Australia. And he's like, with programs like initiatives like our Play for Play program, his mother might have never got out of South Africa and he might never be here today. So that's why he came up with this idea and partnered up with Rise Against Hunger to actually give back. And it's amazing. Last year, last September, just over a year ago, I was lucky enough to go with Rise Against Hunger and a number of people from Australia. So every year we do a vision trip. So it's a trip to one of the countries where the meals go. Last year was South Africa to Johannesburg. So I went with a couple of franchise partners from Australia, a couple of people from head office in Australia, and it was brilliant. We got to see the play for play literally from right at the start, working on farms. Now, when I say working on farms, we were there for a couple of hours, but I wouldn't say we put in too hard graft. We worked on the farm, planting the foods. We saw the meals being packed. Then we actually delivered the meals to townships in Johannesburg, which was such an eye-opener. Just, it would make you really think. And it definitely did make me look at things differently after the trip. And then we actually got to eat the meals alongside the kids in these creches. They call them like little schools for kids in Johannesburg. So we literally got to see play-for-play process working. And it is something we're daily asked about in restaurants. All our staff are fully trained about the play-for-play, what it is. It's on our monthly audits, so staff have to know what it is. So, like, I'd hate to ever hear of a customer coming in and asking a staff member and they don't really know. It's nice when they always say, look, it's for every burrito bowl, we donate someone in need. We're over 42 million meals. And all our stores have a live meal counter as well, which is nice as well, because that's linked to all the sombreros around the world. So it's actually, when you're in the restaurants early in the morning in Australia with 200 plus restaurants is live, it's literally ticking over incredibly fast.
Yeah. And when you say you get asked in the stores, like, people are genuinely interested and, you know, feeling good about having lunch at the same time because they're donating.
Yeah. I definitely noticed it at the start when we opened Hatch Street. And that's when I was very new to understanding it and seeing people's reaction. I remember at the start of Hatch Street, we had an issue where it was one of the teething problems we had in Australian franchise in Ireland, the time difference. What was happening with our live meal counter in store was at 7 in the morning in Australia every night, it was being reset. So our meal counter was turning off during lunchtime. So it'd be off and people would come in. And how I noticed people were picking up on it was, you know, you'd see two customers coming in and one was nearly explaining to the other one and trying to show the clock. And then they'd ask us why the clock isn't working or the meal counter isn't working. So that's what I was like, geez, people actually are taking notice of what we're doing here. And the other thing we try to keep in the restaurants is the actual meal. We keep a packed meal at the counter. So if customers ask, you know, staff member can take it out. It's a little packet with rice, lentil beans, soy, and then it's got a sachet of vitamin and minerals. And then the different areas put in their own different broths and stuff like that.
How did you get involved in the business?
I became involved in Zombrero. So I spent some time in Australia playing rugby, and the guy that got me over there, a good friend of mine and who's now my business partner, Sean McCarthy, he got involved in Zombrero at a very early stage. He opened store 13 for them in Townsville. So he took it from where we were based in Canberra, and he contacted them when they'd only 8 restaurants. They barely had a head office at the time, and he took it from Canberra all the way up to North Queensland. There was rapid rise in Zombrero, and to be honest, like, it was definitely, Sean had a huge impact on the project, on the Zombrero project in Australia. Like, I'd probably never say it to him, but he does like call himself Mr. Zombrero, because he was integral to it. Like, he at one stage, I think they opened 35 restaurants in Queensland across 12 months. He has the rights to Queensland now. So he opened his first one in 2012. There were about 65 restaurants across Queensland and still actively open restaurants, which is amazing. Just before I left Australia, I sort of had some time to kill. I got invited to go on a 7th trip around Asia. I was going to come home for 6 weeks and then go back, which didn't really make any sense. And Sean contacted me to say, look, I'm about to open my second restaurant. Why don't you come up here for a few weeks? You know, you can stay with me and Clara. You can work in restaurants, help us. And I did. I just flew up on a Wednesday. Thursday, he opened a Stockland store, which was his second restaurant. Way ahead of schedule. He'd only opened his first one in May. And again, it was, like I said, it was very early days in the franchise. So there wasn't the supports that we're lucky enough to have now. So everyone was still learning on the run. So for the next 6 weeks, myself, and Clara worked across both restaurants. And I loved it. Look, I just flew up there to help out a friend. I had a little, nearly a Vespa 50cc moped bring me around. So it was quite a sight in North Queensland in the summer where a 6'4" pacey redheaded man was flying around on a little scooter. But I loved it. Look, we were jetting between both restaurants. We were gone from first thing in the morning till late at night. And I was just there having fun. Now, before I left, they obviously looked after me really, really well. And so I went off on the sevens, went back to Ireland. And then about a year and a half later, so Sean was up to 35 restaurants at that stage. Like, it really expanded for him. And he came to me with the idea. So it was actually, sorry, the story behind it was literally exactly 6 years ago, last month, his first child, Manny, was born. So I was contact for all the lads in the rugby club and all his friends still here in Ireland. And I'd rang to the hospital, spoke about them, congratulating them. And then Sean was like, look, myself and Clara have something we'd love to chat to you about, but we'll ring you next week when we're at the hospital. So I hung up the phone and pretty much told anyone who listened that I was going to be godfather. So I was trying to plan out how I'm going to get to Australia for the christening. Would I get time off training? Would it fall at the time there might be a gap in the season? So I'd planned out how I'm going to fly over here, be godfather to the child. So about 2 weeks later, Sean rang me and he just said, look, you know, things have gone well for us in Australia. Some Rose is expanding into New Zealand. They'd started looking at the American project. And then Sam had mentioned about the UK and spoke to Sean because he knew he'd knowledge of living in Ireland for 6 years. And Sean just said, look, I've got an idea. I've a guy there involved in rugby. He would have a good network on the ground. He'd be looking for something for after rugby. He knows a brand. He worked with me here and I'd love to get him involved. And that's really how it started. And, you know, when Sean pitched it to me, you know, I knew straight away this was a great idea. So I never actually was like, I'm going to bring Sombrero back to Ireland. One thing I'll always stand by is when I was in Australia, I was just a fan. I just enjoyed the food, literally ate it regularly with the guys in my house. Mm-hmm. And that's how it started. Like, it was a year and a half later that we opened Hatch Street.
What do you think contributed to the success of Hatch Street and the other outlets since starting then?
I suppose for us, Hatch Street was, you know, for our first year, myself, and so we took on Niall O'Connor, who's our operations manager, who is like, as I always say, he's the brains and I'd be the muscle. But, or good cop, bad cop. But Niall's brilliant. Like, Niall has a background as a chef. He worked in operations and he came on as our operations manager, spent 5 weeks in Australia and then flew straight home and we opened Hatch Street. And the great thing was, at the start, was we were like two managers of one restaurant. In saying that, we were always plotting, you know, to build a foundation to open more restaurants. And it was in our agreement, you know, we'd sort of said we wouldn't open a second one for a year. Also, we had to open three company restaurants in our agreement before we could franchise. So we spent that first year, you know, going into Niall's real details guy, which is brilliant. And, you know, we adjusted the brand on the run, the product. We made some changes to it along the way. And it was just hard work. And it is a simple operation model, like, for us, for staff, a lot of our staff are students, just because the back of house operation that we have set up in it. And it is good, clean food. That's what I stand by. People like the food and, you know, it sits really well in you. And that's, I suppose, what's given us a little bit of success so far anyway.
And when you started, I mean, you had the little bit of experience working in the restaurant for a couple of weeks. What else was your experience at that point to date?
So the year before we opened, the previous June before that March, I had a month off from Leinster and I actually flew over to Australia. So I spent 4 weeks over there working in the restaurants. And I remember at the time seeing some of my teammates putting up photos in Ibiza, Vegas. And literally, I still remember my first day. I went into one of Sean's restaurants. The shift supervisor was an 18-year-old and when I got there first, he told me to jump on dishes. So I was sort of a bit like, all right, grand. So I jumped on dishes for 20 minutes. And then I finished that and I'm like, they're all done for the dish from the morning. And he's like, grand, would you just mop out the kitchen and the cold room? And I was literally like, so I'm there, what is going on here? Like, and then I was thinking, does Sean have me on camera? Because I knew he could access all the cameras. So I was thinking, does Sean have me on camera, like setting me up here? Is this some sort of wind-up? But then he was back in later and he's like, mate, you got to learn literally everything. You're going to have to learn it from bottom to top. And I started all over again. Even though I'd worked in a restaurant previously, I literally went in my first week or so, I was literally just in the restaurant doing everything and anything. Then I got experience. They were opening a store in Logan in Australia, so in Kingston, so I was there for that. And then got to travel around a little bit around Queensland with Sean and actually seeing in auditing restaurants, visiting franchise partners and understanding the business side of it.
So opening up the first three then, I mean, was it difficult to get capital or anything to do that, or was it, I mean, how did you get started
initially? No, it was, so we've a group that own it, and we had capital in it to open three restaurants, and that what we'd always had the, our upfront investment was going to be that. So it wasn't too hard. It's probably site location was very tough, and trying to get sites, particularly at a time we were opening, you know, the property market, particularly in Dublin, was getting very aggressive and very pricey. But that was probably the trickiest thing at the time, trying to get the right sites. Because, yeah, we could have went and opened three sites in 6 months and not even thought about it. But it was trying to get the right locations for us. Now, madly enough, one of them locations was Cork, but it was a location we knew was right beside UCC, right beside the University Hospital, you know, in a great location in Cork. And it's been one of our best sites, to be honest.
What do you look for in a location?
I suppose you always need your Monday to Friday lunch trade. So you need to look around and see what local businesses, if there's now, which is obviously changing at the moment. But pre-COVID, it was always in a good area where there's good businesses. So you're going to have that level of Monday to Friday. So you have your solid lunch trade Monday to Friday. And then it's your evening time. So they're looking at the demographic that's living around you. Like one of our great sites is the Beacon, because one, it has the offices all around it. It's got the hospital across the road, which is staff literally having lunch and dinner at all different times of the day. And then what they also have there is a great demographic in the apartments around there. It's like people from 25 to 35 who are willing to go out and spend on food. And that's why that store has been brilliant for us, because it's sort of, that was the perfect location nearly for us. It's sort of a mix of all them things is what we're looking for.
So how many sites do you have now?
We've got 8 sites now in Ireland. So we just opened our 8th one last month in Tullamore.
So three owned restaurants?
Two fully company-owned restaurants. One that's owned privately, but it's run under the company banner, and then the restaurant franchise.
And is there a plan as to how many you might roll out over the next few years?
No, I wouldn't say there's an exact number on how many we want to, but one thing we're seeing now is regional restaurants being really, really strong. And that's one thing I think COVID, when we come out the other side of it, suburbia lifestyle will become more a thing for people, and probably a bit more like it's in Australia, because if you look at the Australian model, it grew regionally before it grew into the big CBDs. Like even up in Queensland, where Sean opened his stores, there's not actually that many stores in the right centre of Brisbane. That's where the rents are going to be high, but regionally there is. So I think now what we're seeing is, and what I think could happen off the back of this is, off people's working life will change. So they might go to a 3 days in the office, 2 days at home. So they'll be at home, you know, outside the city centre, where they'll be looking for a lunch Monday to Friday. So there's opportunities there. Like Tullamore, I didn't know a massive amount about Tullamore before I got into it. When I looked into it and actually got into it, it's actually a really, really busy town. With lots happening right in the city centre, and it's, yeah, so far it's been good.
This podcast is produced by JetBooks, an online bookkeeping service dedicated to giving you real-time financial information at the click of a button. Head to jetbooks.ie/resources to pick up our free step-by-step guide on how to automate your bookkeeping.
Let's talk about just you for a second. You know, was there anything that you were, I know you were doing dishes and everything, but was there anything you were a little bit overwhelmed by or anything at the start as to, you know, like a steep learning curve into going from being a professional rugby player to running a restaurant? Was there anything that really took you by surprise?
I suppose the one big thing I struggled with at the start was I went from the previous 3 years being told where you are, what you have to do, that your meal's being put in front of you most of the time. And then when we opened up Hatch Street, I had no real schedule and no work-life balance. I was just, literally, I was waking up morning thinking I have to get straight into the restaurant to do stuff. You know, I didn't really have any structure in my life. I'd probably stopped the gym. I'd went from training incredibly hard to then suddenly nothing. And I remember from that March to May, I dropped 10 kilos and literally looked awful. And was like physically exhausted. And I was focusing on the wrong things in Zumbero. I was, you know, running around the place like a madman when I actually needed a bit of structure and schedule in my day. Like, I'd love to be able to go back now and talk to Dara in restaurant one to Dara now, like, because they're two different people. Like, I look for different things in restaurants. I look for different things in staff. I go about my day differently. I focus on different things. And then you also have to have that, you know, work life, you know, and look after yourself as well. Like, you have to still do a bit of training. And I think that's good. Like, I like to do something in the morning to clear the head. And then you can sort of be guilt-free for the rest of the day and work.
What does the rest of the day look like then after you've trained in the morning?
could be a mixture of things, and that's, I suppose, what I like. Like, I'll be involved in everything. Like, I'm quite hands-on in some of the company restaurants. I'm quite hands-on in the franchise restaurants when they open. But it could be anything from, you know, weekly payroll, weekly rosters for the company sites, chatting to franchise partners about, you know, their month. So each month we audit our restaurants. So I'd always have a catch-up at least once a month with the franchise partners. You could be developing marketing schedules for, say, over the past previous weeks, we've been planning for the colleges returning and how that's going to be a little different this year because they're not physically on campus. You can't obviously physically hand out flyers as well. So we've had to go to online to looking at e-flyers and stuff like that. There's the accounting side, the HR side, the marketing side. Like, so there's lots of different things, and that's what I like because there's always something different to do each day.
Tell me about the audits. What's in them? Why do you do them, and how do you do them?
So Niall goes out once a month to all our stores, and he does an audit on everything from the volume of music to the service of food to the quick, to how quick the food is, how quick someone is served from entering the restaurant to leaving. You know, he rates the service along the way, where they offered extras, where they offered a bag at the end, where they tanked as they're leaving, all the way to literally weighing a burrito. So the reason we do this, and I always say it, it's not to trick anyone, catch anyone out, catch them by surprise. It's to protect the brand. And it's so everyone is doing the same thing. I suppose with franchising, consistency is king. We look at McDonald's, best franchise in the world. Mm. You have a Big Mac in Dublin, you have a Big Mac in London, Hong Kong, Singapore, New York. It's a Big Mac. So what we want with Sombrero, and I think we've matched it quite well. We have people regularly in who said, oh, I love this in Australia, and oh, it is the exact same. And it literally is the same. But what we want to have is consistency across all our restaurants. So you don't have one restaurant sending out these huge, massive burritos, then people get a wrong perception, or another restaurant sending out tiny burritos, and then people just get annoyed about it. So it's all about trying to have, you know, everyone on a level playing field and doing the right things. And then in the audit, we'll review the local area marketing with the franchise partners. So we'll always have national campaigns, or Abby, who runs our social media, will look after like general up-to-date updates about Sombrero. But then you look locally, and we'll sit down with the franchise partners. Okay, what's going on around the area? So Cork could be the Jazz Week is going on for Pier Street, the colleges, Trinity College's return at the moment. So we'll try to build something around local area marketing and what's going on. That could even be for a restaurant going out to the local GAA rugby club and getting involved there by giving some free Chiquitos, say, to kids' football teams. But generally, when you give out the free Chiquitos to the kids, they'll bring a family of four maybe with them, and they buy. So different things like that. Then we review their business, you know, where the cost of goods are at, their percentages on their level, or labor percentages. And you're just making that they had to have a good, successful restaurant, and that the controllables are being controlled and they're all under wraps, and then we can help them if we will. And I do think myself and all are very hands-on with our restaurants. We will help them. Like, we'll give anyone a hand if they ask for it. Like, we're constantly available.
So you were talking there about the consistency of the processes and the kind of franchise model. You know, who is it that comes up with the volume of the music, or the size of the burrito, or, you know, the little touches? Is it all coming from Australia, and was it learned through trial and error?
Yeah, I suppose trial and error in Australia. So yeah, the one thing, and this is what I'll always sell to people when I am trying to sell franchises, that it's not just myself and Niall and Tom here on the ground. We have a head office in Australia with HR team, an IT team, a new product development team, a supply chain team. Like, so there's a whole office of, I think, 40 odd people in Australia who are every day just focused on making the brand better and giving improvements. So yeah, it will be trial and error, I'd say, for Australia. Like, the good thing for us here, the way we work in Ireland, so if they launch a new product in Australia, and it's generally done in different seasons. So say 2 years ago, they launched the Summer Bowl for their summer season in Australia. So they ran it through the summer. And what always happens is, yeah, you can test the product, but once you roll out and scale, you're going to find different tweaks, operation you'll make, and some will find a better way or a quicker way or find problems with it. So the good thing with Ireland is we'll have Australia, they'll run it through their summer there. You know, over that summer, there'll be tweaks made to the product, whether it's the operation or the actual product itself. And then by the end of that summer, there's a fairly solid campaign built that then they give to us, and we're ready for our summer here. And then we can just roll it out. So then all we need to do is update the marketing collateral, change euro signs or dollar signs to eurosigns.com.au to .ie. And like, we have a whole product launch ready to go and really easy to roll out to our franchise partners.
have you found that things that worked really well in Australia haven't worked here, or vice versa?
Yeah, there's been different dishes. Like, they have launched dishes in Australia that just haven't gone well for whatever reason. So then we've decided not to do them.
Mm-hmm.
The tiny tortas, which we launched, which are like mini sliders, they actually pulled out of launching that a month before. And I can't remember why the reason, but because it was all built and we liked the idea of it and we'd started looking into it, we actually went ahead and did it. And we've kept it on our menu. The summer bowl for them in Australia, the summer bowl for them in Australia went averagely well. I wouldn't say that well, but it went way better for us here in Ireland. And then we actually just kept it on the menu and renamed it to Sam's House. So that's actually was meant to be a limited time offering that stayed on, that's been on our menu for a year and a half now.
And were the tiny tortas, did they do quite well?
The tiny tortas, yeah, they're very popular. Like, if people get them, they love them, but people are pretty scared sometimes to gamble. But what we were seeing, we were having great success, and they're brilliant for corporate catering or for private functions, because you could send around a platter of them and people were enjoying them like that. But yeah, no, they still haven't launched them. I know New Zealand were only on to us last month because they're going to launch them now soon enough.
So before you got, obviously you kind of fell into it, had you any idea what you might do after rugby?
No, not a little bit. I suppose I've always been quite entrepreneurial. I've always got my hand in little sort of business, I wouldn't say scams, but little any money-making enterprises along the way since I've been quite young. And I had an idea about doing teaching, probably just because, you know, you're finished early in the day, so the summer off. And when I left Australia, to be honest, when I left Australia at 26, I was coming home and I wasn't, the rugby dream at that stage was over. Like, I didn't think in a million years that there was a chance that could happen for me. And I had a little bit of a thought in my mind that I might do teaching. But again, really looking back on it, I'd never committed to it. So if I always think if I really want to do it, I would have committed and signed up to the HDIP course. So I'd sort of come home from Australia with not really knowing what I was going to do. And then, again, you make your own luck, I think. But it was a lot of luck involved. I came home. I was playing with Mary. I came home that Christmas. Like I said, I was 26 at the time. So never in a million years was I thinking Leinster were going to sign me. I actually remember, just before leaving Australia, I sat with my coach, Dan McKellar, who is now actually coach of the Brumbies in Australia and actually just turned down the Australian forwards job. And he sat with me in his office and he's like, look, would you not look at trying professional rugby somewhere else, maybe go somewhere in Europe or a championship? And I was like, look, I chased it. I had a crack, I thought, at that stage. I got a year in Connacht. And if it ended there, like, I was very lucky to get 1 year in Connacht, like, living the life of a professional rugby player. I had a year and a half in Australia, I suppose, living as a pro over there, even though I was sort of playing in a semi-professional setup. And I was like, oh, look, I'm 26. I think it's time I start looking at the future. And he was like, oh, would no one in Ireland look at you? And I remember, like, literally laughing in his office, being like, not a chance. Like, you know, no way. And of all them, not a chance Leinster would even consider me, because, yeah, that just wouldn't happen. And I remember he was like, you know, Jake White said he'd write you a reference. And even at that, I remember just saying, there's not a hope. And I was playing rugby at Mary's, I was enjoying it, I was working a job for a company that sold gym equipment. It was just something to get me back on my feet as I got home, and I was still trying to figure out what I wanted to do. Joe Smith did a pre-match lunch for Mary's against Gary Owen. I obviously watched the match, and I played quite well in it. Also, when I returned my first match back as well, the selector for the Ireland clubs was there, and or the coach, because actually, funny enough, the selector was my dad, was one of the selectors. So nice. I got, although in fairness, that probably went against me, him being my one of the selectors. But yeah, they saw I was back and then invited me down to the Ireland clubs training. So I got involved with that. Joe had seen me play that week against Gary Owen. 2 weeks later, we played Clontarf away on a Friday night. And just by chance, Joe was doing a pre-match dinner on a Friday night and then saw me play again. I'd played quite well twice, and then he'd seen my name being picked for the Irish clubs. So sort of started asking around about me. I'd heard some whispers through people in Leinster, you know, there could be an opportunity for you here. And even at that, I really didn't think there was a chance that was ever going to happen. I got involved then with the end of that A season, played a game against Munster. I remember came on very early and played a game at 12, someone got injured and went okay, and then they brought me to the BNI final. I ended up being 23rd man for that. But sort of was involved, and I didn't mind. Look, it was a nice go out for the trip and good experience. But even at that, I didn't think it would really happen. But I knew that Leinster were losing Fionn Carr and Andrew Conway, who they at the time thought one would stay, but then they lost both of them. The RFU had cut down on foreign signings. So a lot of things just fell into look for me, and I was thinking, geez, this might actually happen. And then Joe Smith got the Irish job, so I was like, that's it, it's not going to happen. And that was May time, and then the next I heard, I got a phone call from Guy Easterby. I was over at the Open with some of my mates in Scotland, and Guy Easterby rang me when Matt O'Connor had just come in as coach, and would you like to come in and do some training with us? And I remember being the worst rugby agent at the time, and I met them. I didn't once ever look for money, anything. It was just like, yeah, no problem, do it. I was thinking at the time, look, if I got a bit of free gear in a few weeks, training with some lads might be good. But the one thing I knew going in there was I knew some of the other guys in my position in the academy or who were even development contracts, and I knew I'd back myself against them. So I thought if I did get in, you know, I could give it a crack. And I went in on a 6-week trial. Then that turned into 3 months, and then ended up staying for 3 years.
Had you improved your game, like when you came back and you were playing quite well and you felt that the dream was over, do you think that you got better at rugby, and do you think that that helped?
Australia was good for my rugby, definitely. You know, it's a lot different when you're playing in sunshine mostly. We're in Canberra, so it's not the prettiest place in the world, but you know, majority of the season you are playing on hard pitches and fast surfaces. Sean, who is now my business partner, was the coach of this team there, and he coached me in Mary's, and he was a massive influence on my rugby career, definitely. You know, he liked to play a good wide game. It suited me. I was getting lots of ball. And yeah, I probably just came back looking at the game a bit differently. I came back and was just literally having fun. Like, you know what I mean? The last game I played with my mates, it was in the Social League in Kinsale. Like, 2 months later after that, I was marking George North and Donnybrook. Like, so it was just worlds apart how it happened so quick. And then I suppose when I got into Leinster, I just got on very well with Matt from early doors. He liked, you know, what I could offer him, and I suited his game plan. And, you know, he just put a lot of faith in me and gave me a lot of confidence.
Is there anything that you would take specifically from having played at Leinster that what you could apply now to your business career?
I suppose for any professional sports person, you know, there is a lot of hard work goes on before you get to, you know, making it as professional sportsters, and when you're there, it is hard now. It is a nice life and it's brilliant, and you know, it was the dream for lots of people. It is the dream for lots of people, and it is an amazing lifestyle. But you do learn about hard work, like, and definitely, you know, you're like, that's one thing I'm not scared of now, is working hard for something or giving it a go. Yeah, I suppose there's lots of things you take from Leinster and the way they do things, and you look at them now and the culture they create. And that's what we try creating our restaurants. Like, I try have a good, happy environment. You know, the one good thing about myself and Niall, and which I like about, is we have a good connection with all staff in most restaurants. Like, today I had to ring the manager and tell him more about something. You know, one of the girls answered, Naomi. I was just able to have a quick chat, a bit of crack with her on the phone before I chat in. And it's nice that, you know, we can go into a restaurant and it's not, oh, the big bad guys from head office are here. It's sort of like, it's fun, it's enjoyable, it's a good place to work, it's a friendly place to work. And that's what we try creating our restaurants and with our own managers and our company stores. I think that's what we have. We have 3 good managers who sort of create that atmosphere.
How important do you think that culture piece is to success?
Yeah, well, it's in our business, I think it's huge, because it's the people on the line serving the food that are our salespeople. Every night front is a salesperson for us. And what I always say to people, you know, if you're rude to one person, that one person goes, tells a mate who tells another mate, and that experience knocks on. And one thing I'll always teach staff and always tell them in their induction when they start with us, you're going to meet the most ignorant people in the world, and you'll just have people who are having a bad day. You don't know what's happened in their life. They literally could have just got divorced before working the door. They could have had a family member pass by, and they come in and be rude to you. I just say, smile, kill them with kindness, just keep being nice, polite, serve them online, and they're literally gone in a minute. So just smile, nod on. It's important for us to have, you know, happy staff who are willing to work, because, you know, we can't be in the restaurants all the time. Our managers can't be in the restaurants all the time. So you got to trust that you have staff in there who actually care, because it's tough. You know, these guys are making 10, 11, 12 euro an hour to really care about it, where it's different when myself and all in there, and you're doing everything you can, or the franchise partners, and it's their restaurant, it's their money. You got to try create it so the guys care about it as much as you do. And we do. We've like, I know across all our 8 restaurants, we've great staff. And I do like the fact, it's probably a weakness how close I am to the staff, but it's also a nice thing that I can go into the restaurants and I'm able to relate with a lot of the staff one-on-one.
Talking about weaknesses, is there anything that you think that you're particularly not good at and that you might not ever get good at?
Probably aren't too close and too hands-on sometimes with certain things, and probably need to be more hands-off. But then again, I like, you know, in the normal world 6 months ago that I'm in Hatch Street, I can jump on the lunch line for half an hour. I'm in Pierce, so I can just jump on. I got into Cork for to catch up with Jess down there and the staff down there, and I just jump and help serve during lunch. Like, I like to be seen out front as well. But on the other side, maybe that could be a weakness, that I need to pull myself out of the business and try to be completely standoff.
What's the biggest mistake you've made during Sombrero?
I suppose the start happened so quick. That probably, like, we spent a year and a half planning, but actually the opening stage of Hatch Street was like a whirlwind. And a lot of that to do was, you know, I was in the middle of being bought out from Leinster. I left Leinster 10 days later, we opened Hatch Street. You know, we were nearly rushing to try open it. Where looking back, I think when we finished our build, finished the fit out and had the restaurant set up, we probably should have spent maybe 2 weeks just, you know, tweaking the product. Because we made mistakes at the start in terms that we just came and took an Australian franchise and was dropped in Ireland and was taught people are just Irish people are the exact same as Australian people, and they're not. And that's what we learned at the start. And operationally, things work different. And even in Australia, they work different store to store in Australia. The same way they work different from Australian stores to Ireland stores. So over that first year, we tweaked the product where I, looking back now, I'm like, you know, we spent all that money, what was 1 month or 2 weeks even, and we could have spent more time doing, you know, a lot more training with staff, a lot more sort of workshops, maybe getting people in to taste the product and getting feedback and changing things and tweaking things that we actually then changed on the run over the first year. So we probably could have got a bit that out of the way. So maybe the due diligence at the start, and we'd done a lot of research, but when we actually got the restaurant finished, we were trying as quick as we could to get it open, and maybe we should have slowed things down and said, right, let's take 2 weeks. It's really intensely work on the product, like, sure, this is what people are looking for, make any tweaks that are needed, and then open.
What changes did you make, or was there an example of one that you...
Well, a really simple one is, in Australia, they serve 80 grams of meat in a burrito. We learned very quick that that's just way too small in Ireland. So we're now up over about 100 to 125 grams. And so that was something we learned really, really quickly. Where if we probably had of, like I say, waited that couple of weeks, we could have tested it, you know, with people coming in and got people's honest feedback. We were trying to adjust on the run then going. And yeah, it was that was probably the main and the simplest one. The other things were all tiny things that a customer probably wouldn't even notice.
Yeah.
But that was one of the big ones for us that we tweaked over the first year. And now we have it, and it's 600 odd gram burrito now. Like, if...
It's an interesting insight, though, isn't it? Like, Irish people want a larger portion, do you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't really know why. It's just like, I suppose it's like you look at America. I suppose you go there and everything there is huge. Yeah. So some restaurants here, yeah, I definitely know a number of them that are known for portions and are really popular. I don't know why that is, but it's definitely, it made a big difference to us as we changed portion size over that first year.
When you run into trouble in the business, or if you have a problem, is there anyone you turn to for advice?
Yeah, a few people. Your Uncle Mick actually is one who I've met. Now, Mick's been
on the podcast?
Yeah, he has been on the podcast, actually. I did hear that one. Mick's brilliant. So my wife's dad has a home and said senior care franchise with Mick's involved in, but I also would have known Mick from back as manager at Ireland, and then he'd be friends with my dad. And I've met him a couple of times for coffees, but I suppose mainly Sean. Like, and I feel like this is a homage to Sean. I hope he never hears this, because he'd never stop going on about it. But yeah, he was huge for me, you know what I mean? He'd been through nearly everything. As he always said when we were opening restaurants here, he owned the worst restaurant in Australia and he owned one of the best. Mm. So he'd everything in the middle.
Yeah.
So he'd seen it all. He'd seen restaurants fail. He'd seen restaurants be massive successes. So at the start, I suppose, with Sombrero, I was literally on to him every morning, every night, with a list of things. Where now our phone calls, yeah, we still speak, because we're obviously very good friends, but we still speak most days. But some days could be just over text, or it could be just a check-in on one thing. And to be honest, like, sometimes it's just really just to have a chat for 5 minutes, and it's not really much to do with the business. But so he's a lot more hands off, but definitely over the first probably 18 months, it was learning a lot from him, and a lot of decisions I was probably scared to make without just running stuff past him. Where now, like, I could ring him and we've made a change, or we've done something, or we've done a deal, and he wouldn't even nearly be privy to it all until it's complete.
is that the Australian market that allowed him to be able to do that? Is it, you know, something to do with his business skills? Like what was the, you know, is there something there?
It goes back to probably earlier saying about mistakes. Probably our franchise package at the start was very aggressive for people out in Ireland. And over that first year, we tweaked it. Before, we had our first franchise partners, Cameron and Marina, who opened the Beacon. Previous to that year, we'd probably lost a number of franchise partners because they'd seen all these massive upfront fees, which isn't common practice in Ireland. But in Australia, franchising is, you know, Snap, Mixed Snap came from Australia. Mm-hmm. It's common practice. There's franchising law in Australia, where in Ireland it's codes of conduct. So it's not as advanced here. Where in Australia, people are really willing to open franchises. It's still quite new here. You know, it is expanding. There's more and more franchise in the country. So probably over that first year, we definitely lost a few people who came in and saw these fees and were just freaked at the start. Where now it's a much more attractive package for people. We've worked on that. We've worked on our supply chain to get the cost of goods down. Where in Australia, I know Sean opened 35, but even before he opened, it was 13. Even as he opened at 35, there was restaurants opening, you know, all over Australia. So their cost of goods are coming down, becoming more and more attractive. That's sort of where we're at now, is we're trying to make the package as attractive as possible to make it as profitable as mm-hmm. possible, because people will come and ask you everything and anything, but what they really care about is, you know, what's the bottom line? What can we make out of these? And I suppose now that we're getting the scale, we're seeing knock-on effects of that in our supply chain.
Would it be desirable to open that many restaurants in a short amount of time? Or do you think a slower approach in terms of franchising is preferable?
Well, if you said to me, I have 35 people that want to open 35 franchises over next year, I'm definitely not going to say no. But in Australia, it was over a much bigger scale. And the brand was growing there in other areas of Australia as well, not just for Queensland, but it was right across the whole state of Queensland, from Cairns, Townsville, down to Brisbane, all across all the smaller regional towns. Mm. Where in Ireland, like I said earlier, now people are looking more a little bit in the regional towns. Like we opened in Tullamore, like what a great site we've opened there. And, you know, I wouldn't even fully thought about Tullamore maybe 6 months ago, a year ago. Mm. But once I got down there and learned about it, like it's an absolute buzzing town and lots happening there. And we're right in the centre of the town. Where, like I said earlier, suburbia lifestyle has become more a thing, where, you know, areas like just outside the city centre, now people, rather than getting a taxi into town for a meal the weekend, might stay locally. Or like I said earlier, people could split a week to 3 days in the office, 2 days at home. So they're going to stay local and look for somewhere for lunch locally.
How important is the economies of scale for, you know, the cost of the supply chain, getting it to be a profitable business for the franchise? How important is that as you get bigger?
Yeah, I suppose for the franchise partners, the managers, we always talk about the controllables. That's your labour percentages, your cost of goods percentages. What we've worked on over the last years, we're constantly working on and still trying to work on it, is getting the restaurants as profitable as possible. And that is mainly true cost of goods. The labour process definitely is a lot more streamlined than when we opened in Hatch Street a couple of years ago. We changed certain things. We changed the cooking methods of the meats. It's been sous vide baths. It's not as hands-on as it used to be. So lots of things that will save your percentage, but there's only so much you can cut back a labour or a roster to. You can't, you could keep cutting it back. You're just losing people off the line. You're slower lunch service. That's what people don't want. So the main focus for us is cost of goods. And now, like I said, we're starting to scale. We're starting to go out directly to companies. Rather than going through a distribution partner, we're going directly to companies. And look, we're buying this many kilos of cheese a year. You know, let's do a deal and see, can we get a reduction in cheese? This many kilos of rice. And that sort of stuff we're trying to work on at the moment. Now, it's obviously at a really difficult time. We're obviously expanding as a lot of these food service companies are struggling because food service is on its knees. So it's kind of a weird time for us, but definitely I think as the market settles, as things start reopening, I'll hopefully have good knock-ons for franchise partners over the next few months. Once these 8 restaurants are back to 100% capacity and, you know, our buying power is a lot better, that's when we'll have the knock-ons where our cost of goods will keep coming in, because, you know, you keep reducing a percent here and there. It's huge for franchise partners.
What else makes it a good buy for a franchise partner?
It's a proven model. Like, it's, I suppose for Ireland we've 8, but Australia there's 200, over 200 now. I do definitely think, I suppose, the after sales service that we give operationally between myself, Niall, Tom, is second to none. I know in some sites that we've opened on alongside other franchises and some really big franchises, the operational support we give in the training, upfront training, and the operational support at the start of opening is way ahead of what other franchises offer. And the reason we do that is we don't want to like open up and walk out of there in day two and write, see you lads, you're on your own, because the only restaurants you hear about is when restaurants are having problems, they'll ring you. And if a manager is a week in, he's struggling and he's falling behind, all that does is, you know, customer isn't getting the right experience, it could be messing up stuff, and you're getting off to the wrong start. So what we want is you get off to the best start possible, everything's been done for you. So what we do in terms of that training is you do 2 weeks in store, you do a week of admin separately to learn about the back of the business, 2 weeks in store, going back to like when I was in Australia, from everything from mopping floors to opening, closing, and running shifts, to then once you open, we give 2 weeks of support after the opening, which is huge, because that's nearly a month alongside Niall, learning everything. And at that stage, you have to leave, because we can stay there for another 4 weeks and run your business, but the manager or the owner will learn nothing. So eventually then we start to pull away, and then I suppose that's that third week, then we probably would normally visit a site maybe once or twice, and it's probably 1 week, but you're on the phone a lot, and then it goes all the way back to your monthly audits. So at that stage, they should be fully trained up and given, you know, perfect sombrero experience to the customer coming in. The store should be running, set up right, and they should know most of the issues at that stage, or most problems, what they should be looking at. They should know exactly how to run a restaurant. And that's why, and then, like I say, we've a head office in Australia with 40 odd people whose constant goal is to improve the business, whether it's through the IT side, through our website, through our ordering platforms, to new product development. So it's that side as well as a big team behind us.
I don't know, you've said to me before that, are there lower staff costs due to the systems and everything that's been built?
Yeah, we definitely, as a franchise model, we do have a really efficient service. Through our cooking methods, through operationally how the restaurants run from open to close, we do try to target about 23% is a really good goal for us. And now we've restaurants running lower than that, but that's a really good target. And talking to some people in different franchises, other restaurant franchises similar to us, we run around at 30%. So it is a really efficient model. It's quite low cost in terms of, like I say, a lot of our staff are students. Most stores have a manager, a few supervisors, and a lot of students, team members who will come in and work through the busy periods, and everyone does everything. So there's no highly skilled chefs in the restaurant. Our meats are centrally cooked, and then they're cooked sous vide in store. So it's sort of hard to mess them up. Sous vide cooking is essentially, it's the meats are cooked inside. So the meats are in the marinade, vacuum sealed, and then it's cooked in a sous vide bath. So some of our meats are cooked for 8 to 18 hours, and they're sous vide cooked in restaurant and served ready to go. So I wouldn't say it's idiot-proof a model, because we've definitely had a couple of questionable staff along the way, but it is a really simple model, and it's hard to get wrong, really.
Mm-hmm. What's the plan for the next few years? How do you see it developing, and what do you want to achieve?
Yeah, completely these plans and goals have changed over the last 8 months, as they have for everyone. You know, at the start of the year, we're really excited. We had a really strong finish to last year. We had a couple of things in the pipeline. You know, January, February, we'd had two huge months. Some of our restaurants were up massively on the same period the previous year. And then, as everyone knows, COVID hit and hit us really, really hard. A number of restaurants closed for that period. And so when COVID hit, we were meant to be opening 3 stores over 5 weeks, sort of the start of April to the start of May. And then they all went on hold, a number of restaurants closed. So to be honest, where I was the start of April with restaurants closed, and I think at one stage we only had 2 open between the Beacon and Pier Street. At that stage, you're literally thinking, geez, if we have all our restaurants still open at the end of the year, you take that, let alone opening new ones. Now, as things started to pick back up, 2 of the 3 restaurants that had planned, we went ahead and opened in June, and 1 the start of August, and then we opened Tullamore the start of September. We still have 2 more in the pipeline. Now, one of the ones that was meant to open in April, that's been delayed to February next year. But at the moment, we're pretty close on having 1 more before the end of the year, which would be huge success. Like I say, from where I was in April, not knowing would you have 1-2 any restaurants at the end of the year to open a new restaurants has been brilliant, and it's been a good confidence booster for the brand and everyone involved in it. I suppose for us, it's keep opening restaurants. I don't want to open restaurants too fast and then lose the sort of hands-on approach to myself and all I have, and how close we are to restaurants and how close we are monitoring standards. So like you said earlier, would we open 35 restaurants? No, we wouldn't open them that quickly. We try to space them apart. But I think for us next year, yeah, if we could open 4 restaurants next year, it would be a successful year for us. Follow us, hoping that, you know, we come out of this crisis.
Taking Ireland into account, how big do you think the market is in terms of the number of restaurants?
Again, I think it's probably got bigger over the last couple of months with, like I say, people working remotely. Regional towns have now come more on a radar that wouldn't have been before. To be honest, all our franchise inquiries probably over the last 6 months, and it was something that someone had said to me early on in the pandemic, was wait till you see, this is a time you'll have loads of inquiries, because people are sitting at home, they're assessing their lives, they're deciding to hate their jobs, they want to try something different. But of all the inquiries, I actually don't think we've had one for Dublin. Yeah, I think since March we haven't had one inquiry for Dublin. Mm. Wexford's been a really popular one for us, Kilkenny, Galway. Now, in saying that, I still remember when we got our very first franchise inquiry, probably a week into opening Hatch Street, and I rang Sean. I was like, mate, we've sold one, it's done. And he's like, yeah, you'll need 50 inquiries before you get one. And you do, and like you say, you get a lot of tire kickers, but... no, we have some really good, strong inquiries at the moment. Like I say, it's been such a good confidence boost for us opening restaurants in a pandemic that people are probably trusting the brand a bit more. And as well, as a brand, we're probably more efficient again or stronger. We've looked at the business differently. I even know our franchise partners, some of them have scaled back certain things, and they're probably more profitable now than they were back in January, February.
Are you still involved in rugby?
No, just... an armchair pundit supporter. I'd still, obviously, at the moment we can't, but I would normally try to get up to the Mary's games, and then the Leinster Ireland games, I just really like to watch on TV rather than going to them. It's nice to be able to stop and rewind or see things clearly, unless you're going for the Christmas game, you've even a few points.
Dara Fanning, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you.
This podcast is produced by JetBooks, an online bookkeeping service dedicated to giving you real-time financial information at the click of a button. Our team of qualified accountants leverage the power of cloud technology to automate your manual processes and cut the cost of your finance function in half. Head to jetbooks.ie/resources to pick up our free step-by-step guide on how to automate your bookkeeping. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and leave a 5-star review. It really helps others to find the show. I'm your host, Connor Carney. Thanks for listening.